Theodore decided, as her carriage wheels clattered away, that the night was too young for him to go to bed. Accordingly, he went to the Pork and spent a couple of contemplative hours over the billiard table. He had much to ponder. Alice had rejected him, but in such a way he could not be wholly despondent. She would, he knew, remember him fondly at least through summer, and he had a tacit invitation to resume his suit in the fall. If Lightfoot, limping down the gangplank of the Boston-New York freighter, looked forward to a lazy summer on Long Island, he was soon disillusioned. No sooner had Theodore arrived back in Oyster Bay than the horse was put into harness and trained to trot and go. Mittie Roosevelt, used to her son's sudden enthusiasms, assumed he was merely having fun. It did not occur to her that deadly serious motives lay behind this interest in elegant locomotion. Even his purchase in August of a dog cart or tilbury, whose seat was just large enough for two slim people, failed to arouse her suspicions. After all, his 21st birthday was approaching, and it was time he learned to drive. Theodore spent much of the summer trying to imitate his father's prowess with reins and whip, not altogether successfully, for graceful, balanced movements never came easily to him. But he was not discouraged. "I am leading the most delightful life a fellow well could," he wrote, exulting in his magnificent health and spirits. As usual, he passed every spare minute in the open air, rowing, swimming, sailing, shooting, mostly at inanimate targets, out of deference to Alice, and constantly challenging Elliot to physical contests. "As athletes, we are about equal. He rows best, I run best. He can beat me sailing or swimming, I can beat him wrestling or boxing. I am best with the rifle, he with the shotgun, etc., etc." Theodore's diaries do not dwell on the 19-year-old Elliot's more obvious superiorities, such as good looks, charm, and sexual attractiveness. That fatally flawed Apollo was still, in the summer of 1879, unaware of the demon that would one day destroy him. An adolescent tendency toward epilepsy had been cured, seemingly, by the Rooseveltian remedy for all ills, travel. After a trip to Europe and two long stays in Texas, he had returned, vigorous and healthy, to take his place as a young banker in New York society. Instantly, friends of both sexes flocked to him, as others had done, years before, to Theodore Sr. Nell had all of Bammy's poise and none of her severity. He was untouched by Theodore's aggressive egotism. Like Corrine, he tended to gush, but his warmth was more genuine. Kindly, open, decent, generous, he indeed was his father's son, were it not for a helpless inability to concentrate on anything but pleasure. As far as girls were concerned, these faults merely added to his appeal. Even Fanny Smith, a lifelong worshipper of his brother, had to admit that Elliot as a young man was a much more fascinating person than Theodore Roosevelt. On 16 August, Theodore's excellent results arrived from Harvard. He was pleased to note that in zoology and political economy, I lead everybody. This double achievement in two such diametrically opposed subjects was enough to reawaken his career dilemma of the previous winter. He had rejected Professor Laughlin's advice to make government, not science, his career. But now, perhaps because Alice had included the effluvia of the laboratory among her reasons for rejecting him, he began to wonder if Laughlin had not been right. Actually, he had already, as he later confirmed, abandoned all thought of becoming a scientist. From now on, politics, not zoology, would preoccupy those parts of his mind not given over to Alice Lee. For 36 precious hours in late August, Theodore was able to worship his beloved in body as well as spirit. En route to yet another vacation in Maine, he stopped off in Boston and spent a couple of nights at Chestnut Hill. Alice accompanied him to a beach party, walked with him through the woods, showed off her graceful prowess on the tennis court, and was his partner at a barn dance. She was so bewitchingly pretty, he could continue north only by heroic self-denial. Had Island Falls not been beyond the reach of any telegram, Theodore would have undoubtedly canceled his booking with Bill Sewell and remained at Chestnut Hill to eat lotus fruit with the Lees. Harsher pleasures awaited him in Aroostook County, where the first chill of fall was already in the air. Since his first trip to Island Falls in 1878, Theodore had been longing to climb Mount Katahdin, whose silhouette massively dominated the western windows of Sewell's cabin. 40 miles away and 5,268 feet high, Katahdin was the highest mountain in Maine and was surrounded by some of the most intractable forest in the Northeast. Now the young underclassman felt sufficiently tough and forest-wise to answer the challenge on the horizon. Arthur Cutler and his cousin Emlyn Roosevelt, who were also vacationing at Island Falls, agreed to join him. After only 2 days of preparation, they helped Sewell and Dow to load up a wagon and set off southwest into a dank, dripping wilderness. If nothing else, the events of the next 8 days made Cutler withdraw his old doubts about Theodore's stamina. Although conditions were wet and slippery, the young man effortlessly toted a 45-pound pack up the ever-steepening mountain. Losing a shoe in a stream, he padded on in moccasins, which protected his feet about as effectually as kid gloves. Yet despite the pain of tramping over miles of rain-slicked stones, he triumphantly reached the top with Sewell and Dow. Cutler and Emlyn remained far below, in a state of collapse. That night, as the rain beat their tents and bedding into a sodden mess, Theodore noted in his diary, "I can endure fatigue and hardship pretty nearly as well as these lumbermen." His fellow New Yorkers could not. As soon as the party got back to Island Falls on 2 September, they left exhausted for home. Having thus, as it were, flexed his muscles, Theodore set off with Bill Sewell on a second expedition to the Munsungan Lakes, compared to which our trip to Katahdin was absolute luxury. It included a 50-mile, 6-day voyage up the Aroostook River in a pirogue, or heavy dugout canoe. Fully half the time they had to drag or push the boat through torrential rapids, pausing occasionally to hack their way through beaver dams and log drifts. They spent 10 hours a day up to their hips in icy water, stumbling constantly on sharp, slimy stones. But oh, how we slept at night, and how we enjoyed the salt pork, hardtack, and tea which constituted our food. By way of relaxing after this bruising expedition, Theodore persuaded Sewell and Dow to take a third jaunt, during which they drove or marched over 100 miles in 3 days. Rain fell unceasingly, but Theodore continued to delight in his superb health and ability to walk, wrestle, and shoot on near equal terms with backwoodsmen. When Sewell and Dow finally put him on the Boston train on 24 September, he declared that he felt strong as a bull. The two big men, watching his skinny arm wave them goodbye, may have had their doubts about that. Sewell, for years afterward, continued to think of him as frail. But they could not fail to be awed by his vitality. He had taken them on in their own environment, and proved himself as good as they. On the morning after his return to Cambridge, Theodore emerged from breakfast at the Pork and found his new dog cart outside the door, lamps and lacquerwork gleaming. Lightfoot waited patiently between its curving poles, long since resigned to the indignity of haulage. The staff of Pike's stable had done a good job. Theodore could see that both horse and cart were in fine condition. His whip stood ready in its sprocket. Neatly folded under the seat lay a rug just large enough to wrap 2 pairs of touching legs. Climbing up carefully, for the dog cart had a notoriously erratic center of gravity, he shook the reins and was soon rolling down Mount Auburn Street in the direction of Chestnut Hill. To his delight, the rig went beautifully, Lightfoot breaking only at the occasional roar of a locomotive. Theodore was conscious of the stares of passers-by, and presumed that he was cutting a fine figure. "I really think that I have as swell a turnout as any man." If by any man he meant his fellow students, he understated the case, for this was the first dog cart ever seen at Harvard, and remained the only one throughout his senior year. With such stylish equipage, he could hardly escape the amused notice of his classmates. Hitherto, he had managed to keep his visits to Chestnut Hill fairly secret, but now rumors began to fly. The amorous Don Quixote, spurring Rocinante across the plain of La Mancha, was no more comic a courtier than Theodore, as he wobbled on tall wheels over the Charles River Bridge. In the words of his classmate Richard Welling, "Some of us were surprised, senior year, when we saw our serious friend Teddy driving a dog cart, and between you and me, not a very stylish turnout. Among the fashionables, there was in those days an exquisite agony about a dog cart which stamped it as the summit of elegance. The driver should hold the reins in a rather choice manner, as though presenting a bouquet to a prima donna, and the long thornwood whip with its white pipe clayed lash should be handled in a graceful way, like fly casting, to flick the horse's shoulder. The cart should be delightfully balanced so that, although the horse trotted, the driver's seat would not joggle. The driver was thus serenely perched on his somewhat elevated seat, and holding his whip athwart the lines, acknowledged the salutes of friends by gently raising his whip hand to his hat brim, his poise never for an instant disturbed. In short, in a horse show where the judges were passing upon fine points of equipment and technique, I fear Roosevelt would have been given the gate. History does not record what Alice Lee thought of this apparition as it creaked to a halt outside the Saltonstall's house. Presumably she was not dazzled as Theodore had hoped, for he studiously avoids mentioning her in his diary entry for the day 26 September 1879. They were all so heartily glad to see me that I felt as if I had come home. On the next page, Theodore writes, "Dr. and Mrs. Saltonstall are just too sweet for anything, and the girls are as lovely as ever." Something is obviously wrong. For the rest of September, all of October, and most of November, he shows a strange reluctance to refer to Alice, even obliquely. Her name appears but once in a list of his guests at an opera party on 16 October. Two pages are ripped out just prior to that date. There is also a reduction in the flow of Theodore's perpetual cheerfulness. Yet the evidence is that he continued to drive over to Chestnut Hill, and his relationship with the rest of that sociable community remained as warm as ever. Only Alice, apparently, was cool. If he was not happy during these first months of his senior year, Theodore was too busy to be depressed. "I have my hands altogether too full of society work," he mildly complained. "Being librarian of the Porcellian, secretary of the Pudding, treasurer of the OK, vice-president of the Natural History Society, and president of the ADQ, editor of the Advocate." His diary makes frequent reference to theater parties and suppers. "I find I don't get to bed too early." Although he had purposely arranged a light study schedule, only 5 courses as opposed to 9 in his junior year, he worked at it 6 to 8 hours a day. He was determined to keep up his 3-year average of 82, and in mid-October proudly informed the Roosevelts, "I stand 19th in the class, which began with 230 fellows. Only one gentleman," Theodore added, with a fine regard for social distinction, "stands ahead of me." He was still, for all the influence of Bill Sewell, an unabashed snob. His idea of a good time during this period of estrangement from Alice was to pile 6 fashionable young men into a 4-in-hand and drive up to Frank Codman's farm, where we will spend the day shooting glass balls, etc. Alice was not at Theodore's side when he turned 21 on 27 October 1879. But his adoring family was, and he saw no reason to be despondent. He would get his girl, he knew it. If still not altogether certain about his career, he at least knew roughly what he would like to do, and his achievements to date, whether social, physical, or intellectual, had not dishonored the memory of his father. For once, he could look back at the past without regret, and at the future without bewilderment. Simply and touchingly, he wrote in his diary, "I have had so much happiness in my life so far that I feel no matter what sorrows come, the joys will have overbalanced them." Sorrows came sooner than he expected. Early in November, Alice's resistance to his advances, hitherto always softened with a hint of future compliance, began to show signs of permanent hardening. Theodore was immediately plunged into a state of sleepless, aching frustration. "Oh, the changeableness of the female mind," he burst out in a letter home, a remark which must have caused the Roosevelt some puzzlement, since he did not go on to explain it. The prospect of failure clearly terrified him. "I did not think I could win her," he afterward confessed, "and I went nearly crazy at the mere thought of losing her." As usual, he kept despair at bay by burying himself in books. For his birthday, he had requested complete editions of the works of Prescott, Motley, and Carlyle, and studying harder than ever. Somehow, he managed to conceal his agony from his classmates. Frederick Almy, class secretary, heard Theodore read a paper at the November meeting of the OK Society and was impressed by his vigorous, confident manner. Roosevelt spoke on the machine in politics, illustrating by the recent election in New York. An interesting discussion followed. "I have a very high opinion of Roosevelt." As Thanksgiving, the anniversary of his vow, approached, he made a desperate, last-minute effort to press his suit. Alice would come out a week after the festival and become fair game for all the eligible young men in Boston. He reasoned that his best hope lay in bringing their respective families together, enmeshing Alice in such warm webs of mutual affection, for he was sure everybody would get on famously, that she would be powerless to break away. With considerable skill, he managed to arrange four such meetings in 20 days. On 2 November, Mr. and Mrs. Lee, Alice, and Rose visited New York and were entertained by the Roosevelts. On 17 November, Bammy and Corrine visited Chestnut Hill, and the Saltonstalls gave a dinner in their honor. On 18 November, the Lees repeated the compliment. Finally, on 22 November, Theodore held an elaborate 34-plate luncheon in the Porcellian, at which elders of all three families were represented. The rest of the company comprised the most attractive of his Boston girlfriends and the most fashionable of his college chums. Perhaps because of Alice's youth, or because Theodore did not wish to arouse premature suspicions, he relegated her to the secondary position on his left. The place of honor went to a Miss Betty Hooper. This 3-week diplomatic offensive paid off handsomely in terms of family goodwill. The Lees were in reported raptures over their New York trip, and his sisters had been effusively welcomed at Chestnut Hill. As for his luncheon, everything went off to perfection. The dinner was capital, the wine was good, and the fellows all gentlemen. For a few days, Theodore basked in the glow of his achievements, then drove out to Chestnut Hill for Thanksgiving, hoping that Alice would now look more favorably upon him. Unfortunately, she did not, although she continued, rather heartlessly, to flirt and tease. He returned to Harvard in a melancholy mood. 4 days later, Alice came out in the traditional shower of rosebuds, and Boston's eligible youth began to circle ominously around her. Theodore was a guest at the party, and in the days following could no longer conceal his violent frustration. "See that girl?" he exclaimed at a hasty pudding function, pointing across the room at Alice. "I am going to marry her. She won't have me, but I am going to have her." As winter settled in and the long evenings dragged out, Theodore felt the loneliness of unrequited love weigh heavily upon him. Unable to find solace in reading books, he began to write one, entitled The Naval War of 1812. His insomnia worsened to the point that for night after night, he did not even go to bed. He wandered endlessly through the frozen woods around Cambridge, declaiming Swinburne. After one such excursion, he refused to return to his rooms. Seriously alarmed, a classmate telegraphed Theodore's family for assistance. Fortunately, James West Roosevelt was staying nearby and rushed to the aid of his stricken cousin. Somehow, the distraught lover was soothed. He did not see Alice at all during the 2 weeks prior to his Christmas vacation. Returning to New York on 22 December, he threw himself determinedly into the usual family festivities. On Christmas Eve, he called in at least 10 very pretty girls, as if to erase from his mind the picture of his beloved. Edith Carrow was among them. "She is the most cultivated, best-read girl I know." All at once, on the day after Christmas, the word Alice joyously reappears in his diary. That young coquette had decided to visit New York for a week, accompanied by a retinue of Chestnut Hillers. Graciously accepting Theodore's invitation to stay, she permitted him to squire her around town, and his delight knew no bounds. "They had an uproariously jolly time," he told his diary, adding in a more reflective moment that her presence at 6 West 57th Street seemed so natural. New Year's Day, 1880, dawned calm and sunny, matching Theodore's mood. He drove his guests out to Jerome Park for lunch and an afternoon of dancing. Alice bobbed and swayed enchantingly in his arms, and he sensed that his long agony would soon be over. Sunday, January 25. "At last everything is settled, but it seems impossible to realize it. I am so happy that I dare not trust in my own happiness. I drove over to the Lees determined to make an end of things at last. It was nearly 8 months since I had first proposed to her, and I had been nearly crazy during the past year. And after much pleading, my own sweet, pretty darling consented to be my wife. Oh, how bewitchingly pretty she looked! If loving her with my whole heart and soul can make her happy, she shall be happy. A year ago, last Thanksgiving, I made a vow that win her I would if it were possible. And now that I have done so, the aim of my whole life shall be to make her happy, and to shield her and guard her from every trial. And oh, how I shall cherish my sweet queen! How she, so pure and sweet and beautiful, can think of marrying me, I cannot understand, but I praise and thank God it is so." The engagement was kept secret pending family approval. For several days, Theodore could not believe his luck. "I still feel as if it would turn out, as it so often has before, and that Alice will repent." But she did not. Now that her defenses were down, he could kiss and cuddle her as often as he wished. In a daze of delight, he rushed to New York to break the news to his family. Mittie Roosevelt was stunned, but thanks to her prior exposure to Alice, wholly satisfied. The girl had beauty, grace, and humor, qualities for which she herself had been famed in her time. As for Theodore, Mittie had long since recognized that he, not Elliot, was his father's son. Decisive and masterful, a man who knew exactly what he wanted. Right now, it was a diamond ring for my darling. While he shopped for it, Mittie wrote Alice a delicate, violet-scented note, formally welcoming her into the family. The reply came by return of post, and reassured her that Alice, no longer the coquette, was as deeply in love as Theodore. Chestnut Hill, February 3, 1880. "My dear Mrs. Roosevelt, I feel almost powerless to express my thanks and appreciation of your sweet note received this afternoon. Full of such kind assurances of love and welcome, it is more than kind, and feeling so unworthy of such a noble man's love makes me feel that I do not deserve it at all. But I do love Theodore deeply, and it will be my aim both to endear myself to those so dear to him and to retain his love. How happy I am, I can't begin to tell you. It seems almost like a dream. It is such pleasure to have known all his loved ones, and not to feel that I am going amongst perfect strangers. I just long for tomorrow to see Theodore and hear all about his visit home. I was so afraid you might be disappointed when you heard what he went on for, and I assure you my heart is full of gratitude for all your kindness. With a great deal of love, believe me, ever yours devotedly, Alice Hathaway Lee." There remained the problem of reconciling the Lees to the premature loss of their daughter. Although that amiable couple had no objection to Alice's early engagement, Theodore foresaw a battle royal in winning their consent to her early marriage. With his usual regard for the calendar, he hoped to announce the former on Valentine's Day and celebrate the latter on his birthday, 27 October. Even that 8-month interval would likely be too short for Mrs. Lee. Alice wanted to press for a fall wedding, but he wisely left the date open when negotiating with her father. Pleased at this show of responsibility, George Cabot Lee made the engagement official on 14 February, 1880, and Theodore was free to dispatch a series of triumphant announcement notes to his friends. "I have been in love with her for nearly 2 years now, and have made everything subordinate to winning her." Now that Alice was his, Theodore's natural exuberance, so long bottled up, burst out like champagne. His letters and diaries for the months following are awash with adoration. "My sweet, pretty, pure queen, my laughing little love. How bewitchingly pretty she is. I cannot help petting her and caressing her all the time. And she is such a perfect little sunshine. I do not believe any man ever loved a woman more than I love her." Although the February weather was snowy, he drove constantly to Chestnut Hill, the horse plunging to his belly in great drifts, impatient to be in the arms of the purest, truest, and sweetest of all women. When his family arrived in Boston later that month for a round of festive luncheons and dinner parties, Theodore worked himself up to such a pitch of excitement that he went for 44 hours without sleep. For all his joy, there came now and again, cold as ice in his stomach, a reminder that he had very nearly failed. "The little witch led me a dance before she surrendered, I can tell you," he confided to his cousin John. "And the last 6 months have been perfect agony. Even now, it makes me shudder to think of some of the nights I have passed." He remained insecure about Alice long after the Lees agreed, in early March, to a fall wedding. "Roosevelt seemed constantly afraid," recalled Alice's cousin, "that someone would run off with her and threaten duels and everything else. On one occasion, he actually sent abroad for a set of French dueling pistols." Planning an Easter visit to New York with Alice, he was naively anxious to impress his local friends at a dinner in her honor. "I want to include everybody, so as to rub up their memories about the existence of a man named Theodore Roosevelt who is going to bring a pretty Boston wife back to New York next winter." As the weather softened and Alice remained faithful, Theodore learned to relax. By 1 April, he was able to note smugly that, in spite of being engaged, She was certainly the belle of the Harvard Assembly. In order to spend every available minute with her, he resigned many of his official positions, including the vice presidency of the Natural History Society, neglected his editorship of The Advocate, and began to cut recitations freely. His study hours dwindled from 36 to 15 a week. "My marks were so good the first 3 years that I can afford to be idle now." Already he was bored with scholastic honors. The fact that he had scored 94 and 98 in 2 semi-annuals, written in the same week he successfully proposed to Alice Lee, did not seem remarkable to him. Now that Theodore's romance was common knowledge on the yard, he not unnaturally became something of a figure of fun. Professor A.S. S. Hill, his instructor in forensics, was so amused by the precocious sentimentality of a Rooseveltian essay that he read it aloud to the class, keeping the name of the author secret. Afterward, he waspishly asked Theodore to criticize it and sat back to enjoy the young man's blushes. Theodore's dog-cart and dandified appearance, he now sported a silk hat, regarded as the non plus ultra of college fashion, did not escape the satire of Owen Wister, who wrote the songs for the DKE theatricals. During one burlesque production of Der Freischütz, the chorus launched into a serenade about the cove who drove his doggy Tilbury cart, awful tart and awful smart, with waxed mustache and hair and curls, brand new hat, likewise cravat, to call upon the dear little girls. Wister, gleefully pounding the piano, was unaware that the incensed cove himself happened to be in the audience. Next morning, rumors circulated that Teddy Roosevelt was very angry and had muttered something about bad taste. Wister innocently claimed that since Roosevelt's mustache was not waxed, his lyrics were not libelous. He might have added that Theodore had no mustache at all, only whiskers. But the latter was too much in love to stay angry for long, and looked puzzled when Wister apologized. They soon became fast friends. Theodore was attracted by the sophomore's wit and intelligence, while Wister was one of the first to define the peculiar glow of the mature Rooseveltian personality. During the past few years, this glow had only flickered at sporadic intervals. Now it began to beam forth steadily, throwing Theodore into ever greater prominence against the muted backdrop of Harvard. "He was his own limelight and could not help it," Wister wrote many years later. "A creature charged with such a voltage as his became the central presence at once, whether he stepped on a platform or entered a room." The voltage, of course, was stimulated by Alice. Its radiance suffuses almost all the diary entries in that spring of 1880. On the fresh April mornings, they played tennis together, she gracefully mobile in her long white dress, he awkward and jerky, clutching his racket halfway up the spine. Later, while Alice sewed, he read to her from Prescott's Conquest of Peru. They took endless drives in the dog cart, with Alice prettily perched beside him in his high seat, as Lightfoot, losing weight rapidly, bowled them along miles of blossom-strewn roads. In the evenings, they sat at whist and listened to the younger Lees practicing the piano. Before bedtime, Theodore generally managed to sneak Alice off for an hour alone in the moonlight. "How I love her! She seems like a star of heaven. She is so far above other girls. My pearl, my pure flower. When I hold her in my arms, there is nothing on earth left to wish for. And how infinitely blessed is my lot. Oh, my darling, my own best-loved little queen." Theodore's engagement seems to have removed the last vestiges of doubt concerning his future. "I shall study law next year, and must there do my best and work hard for my little wife." He had already made it clear that he considered law a stepping stone to politics, and confirmed that larger ambition in a conversation with William Roscoe Thayer. The occasion was a meeting of Alpha Delta Phi in Holworthy, shortly before commencement. Roosevelt and I sat in the window seat overlooking the college yard, and chatted together in the interval when business was slack. We discussed what we intended to do after graduation. "I'm going to try to help the cause of better government in New York City. I don't know exactly how," said Theodore. I recall still looking at him with an eager, inquisitive look and saying to myself, "I wonder whether he is the real thing or only the bundle of eccentricities he appears." Theodore was, however, in dead earnest. For his senior thesis, he chose the most controversial political subject of the day. It was entitled, "Practicability of Giving Men and Women Equal Rights." The very first sentence struck the keynote of his career as a politician. In advocating any measure, we must consider not only its justice, but its practicability. Some of his less realistic classmates were shocked by this frank admission that a principle could be both just and impracticable. Yet Theodore made no bones about his real feelings later in the document. A cripple or a consumptive in the eye of the law is equal to the strongest athlete or the deepest thinker, and the same justice should be shown to a woman, whether she is or is not the equal of man. As regards the laws relating to marriage, there should be the most absolute equality preserved between the two sexes. I do not think the woman should assume the man's name. I would have the word obey used not more by the wife than the husband. By these remarks, Theodore laid himself open to charges of effeminacy, and at least one instructor suggested he was too much influenced by feeling to be entirely masculine. For the rest of his life, he would remain acutely aware of the needs and sensibilities of women. Few things disgusted him more than male sexual viciousness, or the Victorian conceit that a wife is the servant of her husband's lusts. Although a woman's place was in the home, he believed that the home was superior to the state, and that its mistress was, therefore, the superior of the public servant. The question of suffrage, as his dissertation made plain, was not so much controversial as unimportant. If women wished to vote, then they should be allowed to do so. Yet he could not resist adding, "Men can fight in defense of their rights, while women cannot. This certainly makes a powerful argument against putting the ballot into hands unable to defend it." On 30 June 1880, Theodore Roosevelt graduated from Harvard College as a B.A. magna cum laude, 21st in a class of 177. His family was present in force, and so was a large contingent from Chestnut Hill. President Eliot placed an embellished diploma in his hand and murmured the special congratulations due a Phi Beta Kappa. Marching back to his seat in the bright sunlight, with his gown swirling triumphantly and a battery of adoring eyes upon him, Theodore could be excused a moment of self-satisfaction. His academic record was excellent. He was already, at 21, a prominent member of society in Cambridge, Boston, and New York. He had been runner-up in the Harvard Lightweight Boxing Championship. He was rich, pleasant-looking, and within a limited but growing circle, popular. He was the author of 2 scholarly pamphlets, a notable thesis, and 2 chapters of what promised to be a definitive naval history. To crown it all, he was engaged to a beautiful young woman. "Only 4 months before we get married," he told himself. "My cup of happiness is almost too full." Yet there was wormwood in his cup, unknown to anybody but the graduate and Dr. Dudley A. Sargent, college physician. On 26 March, after announcing his engagement, Theodore had undergone a complete physical examination and had been told to his satisfaction that he had gained 12 pounds since coming to Harvard. But the doctor had other, less satisfactory news. Theodore's heart, strained by years of asthmatic heavings and overexercise, was in trouble. Far from climbing mountains in Maine, he must in future refrain even from running upstairs. He must live quietly and choose a sedentary occupation. Otherwise, Sergeant warned, he would not live long. "Doctor," came the reply, "I'm going to do all the things you tell me not to do. If I've got to live the sort of life you have described, I don't care how short it is." Having spat the wormwood out, Theodore refused to acknowledge that he had ever tasted it. His diary for that night does not even mention the interview, although it is confirmed by Harvard records. Not even Alice Lee, to whom he had promised to tell everything, was permitted to know what ailed her future husband. Right through commencement, Theodore continued to protest his health, happiness, and good fortune. On the following day, he could write, with such conviction that every word was heavily underscored, "My career at college has been happier and more successful than that of any man I have ever known." Alice joined Theodore at Oyster Bay for the first 10 days of July. As he proudly escorted her through the landscapes of his boyhood, he vowed, "She shall always be mistress over all that I have." Perhaps this was when the idea of building her a great house overlooking the bay first entered his head. One hill in particular, King Olaf would have called it a holm, with its sandy bottom, wooded slopes, and grass-covered crown, he loved above all others. As a teenage ornithologist, he had spent countless hours crouched in its coverts, notating the songs of birds in his own peculiar phonetics. Chee-chirrrr,
flip, flip, turkey, prl, chick, chick.
As a Longfellow addict, he had no doubt spent as much time sitting in that hot grass and seen sails of silk creep over the horizon. Soon he would build a manor on that hill and live, as Olaf had done, surrounded by his own fields and looking down upon his own ships. Well, a rowboat at least. The house would be called Liholm, after his queen. And there they would live out their days. Theodore could indulge such fantasies in this final summer of boyish irresponsibility, without worrying about such trivia as proprietary rights, mortgages, and deeds of sale. Time enough for them when he took up the duties of a husband and taxpayer. In the meantime, he wished to have fun, and fun meant violent exercise. He would spend 3 months of such frenetic activity that his heart would simply have to correct itself or give out in the attempt. Although Theodore did not state this alarming ambition in so many words, his list of activities for the period makes it quite plain that he intended to keep his promise to Dr. Sargent. I'm going to do all the things you tell me not to do. For the first few weeks at Oyster Bay, he swam, rowed, hiked, and played tennis. On 20 July, he accompanied Alice, Rose, and Dick Saltonstall to Bar Harbor, Maine, and promptly began to scale mountains, play tennis, bowl, and go for long hikes through the perfectly magnificent scenery. Within 3 days, his body began to give off signals of distress, and he fell victim to an attack of cholera morbus. "Very embarrassing for a lover, isn't it?" he complained to Corinne. "So unromantic, you know. Suggestive of too much unripe fruit." But he was up again next morning, and added dancing to his exercise schedule. Alice's 19th birthday, on 29 July, worked him into such a paroxysm of adoration that he collapsed afterward, and the cholera morbus struck again. This time Theodore was unable to get up for 2 days, but Alice nursed him so tenderly, he decided he rather liked being sick. One more adventure remained to him as a bachelor, a marathon hunting trip in the West, which he had long been planning with Elliot. "I think it will build me up," he told Mitty, in tacit admission his health was not what it might be. The two young men left New York for Chicago on the night train of 16 August. Within 24 hours, Theodore was gazing through the windows at a horizon wider and a sky loftier than any he had ever seen. Lakes as big as seas passed by on his right. Farms as big as European countries unrolled to his left. The sheer immensity of America stirred something in him. For the rest of his life, big was to be one of his favorite words. Chicago, which they reached early on the 19th, was anticlimactic. "It certainly is a marvelous city," Theodore wrote Bammy, "of enormous size and rich, but I should say not yet crystallized. There are a great many very fine houses, but I should rather doubt the quality of the society." Anyway, it was prairies, not parlors, that he and Elliot had come to see. For the next 6 weeks, they hunted in Illinois, Iowa, and Minnesota, with an assortment of guides, not finding very much game, but reveling in the informality of frontier life. "We are dressed about as badly as mortals could be," Theodore boasted, "with our cropped heads, unshaven faces, dirty gray shirts, still dirtier yellow trousers, and cowhide boots." He assured Bammy that his slovenliness was temporary. "We expect to return in 3 weeks or so. Will you send to 6 West 57th Street my long traveling bag with my afternoon suit, 2 changes of underflannels, 6 shirts, 6 pair silk socks, handkerchiefs, neckties and pin, 2 pairs of low shoes, brushes, razors, and my beaver and my top hat, also a pair of pajamas." Less than halfway through the trip, the young dandy's thoughts were clearly racing eastward. Theodore was still too much a New Yorker and too preoccupied with thoughts of marriage to enjoy fully his first exposure to the West. His initial excitement dwindled as the weeks dragged by and illness continued to plague him. Although he protested superb health in letters home, his diaries record continual attacks of colic that made it difficult for him to walk, and asthma so severe he had to sleep sitting up. Other misfortunes combined to aggravate his homesickness and longing for Alice Lee. Both his guns broke, he was bitten by a snake, thrown headfirst out of a wagon, soaked in torrential rainstorms, and half frozen in a northwesterly gale. Elliot, who had already spent a year in the West, seemed much more at home. Yet beneath the jolly exterior, Theodore saw signs of a discontent much deeper than his own. Using as light a touch as possible, he warned the family about it. As soon as we got here, Chicago, he took some ale to get the dust out of his throat. Then a milk punch, because he was thirsty. A mint julep, because it was hot. A brandy smash, to keep the cold out of his stomach. And then sherry and bitters to give him an appetite. He took a very simple dinner. Soup, fish, salmi de grouse, sweet bread, mutton, venison, corn, macaroni, various vegetables, and some puddings and pies, together with beer, later claret, and in the evening shandigaff. I confined myself to roast beef and potatoes. When I took a second help, he marveled at my appetite, and at bedtime wondered why in thunder he felt stuffy and I didn't. On 24 September, the brothers compared their respective game bags. Theodore had shot 203 items, Elliot 201. Allowing for seniority, they could call it quits. By now the wind coming off the Great Lakes was bitingly cold, and it was time to go home. Early on 29 September, they arrived in New York. Theodore stopped only long enough to pick up his suitcase of finery before speeding on to Boston. Alice was waiting for him, lovelier than he had ever seen her. She had a certain added charm that I do not know how to describe. I cannot take my eyes off her. She is so pure and holy that it seems almost a profanation to touch her, no matter how gently and tenderly. And yet when we are alone, I cannot bear her to be a minute out of my arms. The last few weeks before the wedding were a predictable blur of activity. From Chestnut Hill, Theodore hurried back to New York and lavished $2,500 on jewelry for his beloved. I have been spending money like water for these last 2 years, but shall economize after I am married. He managed a couple of quick weekends at Oyster Bay and promised Mitty that he would remain a good son. The enigmatic Edith Caro entertained him at dinner. Another old flame, Fanny Smith, was present and found him as funny and delicious as ever and wild with happiness and excitement. Then he was off again to Boston and spent his final weekend as a bachelor on an estate near Salem, having larks and chopping down trees in a vain effort to stay calm. On 26 October, the eve of his wedding, he checked into the Brunswick Hotel along with a large party of New York friends and, in wild spirits, tipped Fanny's chair back until she feared she would do a reverse somersault. Later, he went up alone to his room. At midnight, he would be 22, and 12 hours later, he would be married. Tomorrow, there would be another person in his bed. My happiness is so great, it makes me almost afraid. Chapter 5. The Political Hack. To avenge his father slain, and reconquer realm and reign, came the youthful Olaf home. It was the dearest little wedding, Fanny Smith reported in her diary of 27 October 1880. Alice looked perfectly lovely, and Theodore so happy and responded in the most determined and Theodore-like tones. Bride and groom had emerged from the Unitarian Church, Brookline, into the splendor of a perfect fall afternoon. Indian summer warmed the air and cast a mild glow over the surrounding countryside. Coats and hats were dispensed with on the short drive to Chestnut Hill, and the agreeable holiday mood of a Wednesday wedding spread from carriage to carriage. At the reception in the Lee Mansion, sunshine and champagne generated such euphoria that even Edith Caro, who of all the guests had the least reason to celebrate, danced the soles off her shoes. The young couple took their departure around 4 o'clock and traveled to Springfield, where Theodore had reserved a suite of rooms at the old Massasoit house. Later that evening, he noted tersely in his diary, "Our intense happiness is too sacred to be written about." They journeyed on to New York the next day. There was to be no official honeymoon, only a quiet fortnight together at Oyster Bay. Since Theodore was already registered for the fall and winter terms at Columbia Law School, he could not afford to cut too many classes. Alice was consoled with the promise of a 5-month vacation in Europe the following spring. Mitty Roosevelt had placed tranquility at the disposal of the newlyweds. When they arrived, late on Thursday afternoon, they found the house empty save for 2 maids, an old black groom, and 1 melancholy cat. Theodore's rowboat rocked at the jetty. The other houses around the bay were shuttered up, their piazzas strewn with fallen leaves. Wooded hills, flaming red and rusty gold as the setting sun caught them, sealed the little community off from the rest of Long Island. Supper had already been ordered by the thoughtful Bammy. Theodore and Alice had nothing to do but luxuriate in each other's company. For the next 2 weeks, they would spend hardly an hour of the 24 apart. A sense of delicious privacy, of port after stormy seas, possessed Theodore as he settled into the domestic routine which he would always consider the height of human bliss. "I am living in a dreamland," he told himself. At breakfast, Alice prettily presided over the tea things, in the daintiest little pink and gray morning dress, while I, in my silk jacket and slippers, sit at the other end of the table. Later she proved herself his equal on the tennis court, and kept pace with him on long, fast walks through the countryside. There were many excursions, no doubt, up the slopes of Theodore's favorite hill. Alice was persuaded to approve the purchase, for $10,000, of an initial 60 acres overlooking the bay. Together they devoured the newspapers, our only intercourse with the outside world, and endlessly discussed everything from politics to poetry. They took afternoon buggy rides over the hills, evening rows across the bay, and feasted on woodcock and partridge. After dinner, Alice would curl up in front of a roaring wood fire, while Theodore read aloud from the novels of Scott and Dickens. All through the night, her long, soft body lay beside his. How I wish it could last forever! Mr. and Mrs. Theodore Roosevelt, Jr. took up formal residence at 6 West 57th Street, New York City, on Saturday, 13 November, 1880. They were welcomed back with a perfect ovation by the rest of the Roosevelt clan, and Theodore lost no time in assuming the mantle of Elijah. On Sunday, after church, he presided over the traditional family lunch, was at home to a variety of relatives and friends in the afternoon, and that evening sat in his father's seat at the Newsboys' lodging house dinner. Before the winter was out, he would inherit two more of Theodore Sr.'s responsibilities, being elected a trustee of both the orthopedic dispensary and the New York Infant Asylum. But the charitable role did not suit him. Many years later, he told a friend, "I tried faithfully to do what Father had done, but I did it poorly, and in the end, I found out that we each have to work in his own way to do our best. And when I struck mine, though it differed from his, yet I was able to follow the same lines and do what he would have had me do." Striking that way took Theodore a full year, although, as things turned out, it led a mere 100 yards east of his front door. Two other routes temporarily diverted him. The first led 3 miles south to Columbia Law School. Emerging from 6 West 57th Street early on the morning of 17 November, Theodore sucked in a lungful of chill, crisp air, marriage had done wonders for his asthma, turned into Fifth Avenue, and marched briskly downtown to 8 Great Jones Street. It was a good 45-minute walk, even at the characteristic Rooseveltian gait. Arms pumping, toe cap shooting out sideways, every heel fall biting like a pickaxe. Theodore's first recitation was scheduled for 8:30, and he did not want to miss a word that fell from the golden lips of Professor T.W. Dwight, America's most revered legal pedagogue. The Columbia College Law School, which Dwight had founded in 1858, was little more than a cavernous old house, its floors and walls blotched with tobacco juice, its windows jammed shut against the traffic noises of Lafayette Place. Within, an atmosphere of rowdy informality prevailed. Students threw their hats and coats over every available protuberance, argued boisterously in the library, and fought for places in a stuffy little lecture theater. Those who arrived late were obliged to squat around the platform, or wedge themselves into dusty windowsills until there was not an inch of standing or sitting space left. From the moment the white-haired, mildly smiling professor strolled into the room, a cathedral-like hush descended. Dwight was famous for the clarity and persuasiveness of his oratory, the profundity of the questions with which he would every now and again challenge his audience. No conundrum was too knotty for him to untangle, no statute too obscure to exhume and ponder. The thin blood of 7 generations of Puritan clergymen, authors, and educators flowed in his veins. His logic was unpolluted by human emotion. Professor Dwight and his students now discovered that they had in their midst a young man who was impatient with logic, and who, instead of waiting for questions from on high, wished to ask his own. Theodore, at Columbia, proved to be as harshly persistent an interrupter, as irrepressible a jack-in-the-box, as he had been at Harvard. Time and again he would leap to his feet, glasses flashing, to argue for justice and against legalism, and express his contempt for the repellent doctrine of caveat emptor. Why, the young man wanted to know, did this side of the law preclude bargains which are fair and of benefit to both sides? He shrilly insisted that the accepted standards of corporation lawyers were incompatible with youthful idealism. They encouraged sharp practice. Theodore's pertinacity in raising such subjects vastly irritated a fellow student, Pulteney Bigelow. Roosevelt was then what he was in the White House, an excellent example of the genus Americanus egotisticus. Bigelow may have been a prejudiced witness. Those who hated Theodore did so with passion. Yet he early detected the future president's lifelong compulsion for center stage. He was predestined for politics. He could not escape the fate of being persistently in the public eye. Professor Dwight, on the other hand, did not seem to mind Theodore's interruptions. Most of the other students were impressed by the newcomer. He quickly became a favorite and was accepted as a man with a future, although it was plain to all but himself that he had no future in law. As one classmate dryly put it, the intricacies of the rule in Shelley's case, the study of feudal tenures as exemplified in the great work of Blackstone, were not the things upon which that avid mind must feed. All through the winter and spring of 1880-81, Theodore continued to march down Fifth Avenue, Blackstone's commentaries under his arm and a determined expression on his face. "I like the law school work very much," he told himself. The second route that Theodore followed at the close of his morning classes led west from the law school to the Astor Library, on the other side of Lafayette Place. Here he proceeded mysteriously to bury himself in speckled tomes and ancient periodicals. He remained close-mouthed about this scholarly activity, not even mentioning it to his diary until March 1881, and then with deliberate vagueness. "I'm still working on one or two unsuccessful literary projects." Just when Theodore became aware of his potential as a writer is unclear. His juvenile letters and diaries had been no more remarkable than those of any intelligent boy. His adolescent notebooks and ornithological pamphlets were strictly scientific. His Harvard themes were laborious, unimaginative, and lacking in style. Even his eulogies for Theodore Sr. and effusions over Alice Lee, while undoubtedly passionate, were expressed in Victorian clichés. Only rarely, as in the stories he used to improvise as a bedridden boy, the humorous letters from Dresden, and the descriptions of birdsong in the Adirondacks, had he shown any flashes of originality. These somehow seemed to have convinced him that the name Theodore Roosevelt might one day ornament the spine of this or that leather-bound volume. From his late teens on, he'd begun to write, consciously or unconsciously, to an audience. Even the diaries he ostensibly marked private show signs of this urge to communicate. It is impossible to read them at any length without feeling that one is being addressed. Many entries are deliberately prosy and tell Theodore's imagined readers things he does not need to tell himself. Even when he wishes to be genuinely private, he feels the stare of the public and is obliged to erase paragraphs, tear out whole pages, and curtly announce that some things are too sacred to be written about. That other instinct of the born author, the compulsion to write, was also strong in him. Theodore's habit in moments of joy or sorrow had always been to reach for a pen, as others might reach for a rosary or a bottle. During the winter of 1879-80, when Alice was driving him to despair, he had begun to write a book, the most technically challenging one he could think of. Now, in the happy winter of 1880-81, he turned again to the Naval War of 1812. Although Theodore protested that the two introductory chapters he had already completed at Harvard were so dry they would have made a dictionary seem light reading by comparison, he was entitled to be proud of them, for they were a formidable achievement. Before starting the book, he had known little about academic research and less about marine warfare. Merely to master the technicalities of naval strategy and tactics, along with a complex nautical vocabulary, was a task before which any professional historian might quail. To collect and analyze, in terms of comparative firepower, thousands of ballistic and logistic figures, correcting the inaccurate ones passim, required the brain of a mathematician, which Theodore did not have. So he had to double-check his calculations until every last discrepancy had worked itself out. Yet somehow he had managed to do all that. Whether successfully or not, the reviewers would have to decide. In the meantime, with his 42 dry pages behind him, he could move on to 450 more full of the spray and salt and smoke of real battle. Despite the enthusiasm with which he took up this work, Theodore was determined not to let his imagination run away with him. He made full use of the research facilities of the Astor Library in an effort to document every sentence of his manuscript. He consulted naval histories published on both sides of the Atlantic, including several French works which he quoted in his own translation. He burrowed through the lives and memoirs of participating admirals. Determined to be scrupulously fair, he consulted such British sources as the Naval Records, Niles Register, and the London Naval Chronicle. He sent to Washington for carloads of official captains' letters, logbooks, and shipyard contracts previously untouched by any scholar. He compiled his own construction plans, tactical diagrams, and tables of comparative force and loss. With these spread out around him, he could ponder such questions as the relationship between a ship armed with long 12s and another presenting 32-pound carronades. Which one would prevail in battle? At long range the first, and at short range the second, concluded Theodore, who dearly loved a balanced statement. But then the booming of guns in his ears would be interrupted by the library clock chiming 3. It was time to march back uptown and take Alice out for her afternoon drive. Apart from his daily 6-mile walk, sleigh driving was Theodore's only exercise that winter. He went about it with his usual energy, speeding around Manhattan in huge loops up to 30 miles at a time, while the rest of society sedately circled Central Park. With his sweet baby warmly wrapped in buffalo robes beside him, and Lightfoot's hooves drumming up an exhilarating spray of snow, he would zigzag through the farms and shanties of the Upper West Side until the dark, ice-clogged waters of the Hudson opened out on their left. Spinning north along Riverside Drive, they would admire the snowy palisades showing in fine relief against the gray winter skies, before curving east across the white fields of Harlem, and south past the great estates of the East River, into the pine-forested freshness of Jones Woods. Emerging at 68th Street, they would zigzag toward the mansions of Midtown, massed like an interrupted avalanche along the southern fringe of Central Park. Should they pass Mrs. William Astor's carriage in Grand Army Plaza, Theodore could touch the brim of his beaver with his whip and know that the gesture would be acknowledged, for the Roosevelt family was eminent enough to be included among the few hundred that majestic lady deigned to recognize. Mrs. Astor's dominance over New York's drawing rooms was so complete that her word was social law. She was a guest, along with the Vanderbilts, Dodges, Harrimans, and Eastlands, at Corrine Roosevelt's coming-out party on 8 December. Although the Grand Dame was so stiff with diamonds she could barely turn from one guest to another, she liked what she saw of Theodore and Alice, and invited them to dinner at her austere brownstone on 34th Street, whose boards the nouveau riche Vanderbilts were not permitted to tread. As a double seal of her approval, she asked the young couple to her January ball, the traditional climax of the social season. At this event, and at the scarcely less glittering Patriarch's Ball, and at banquets with Mrs. Stuyvesant Fish, and parties at Delmonico's, and Monday nights at the opera, and at dozens of other receptions, teas, and jolly little dinners up and down Fifth Avenue, Theodore and Alice conducted themselves with the grace of natural aristocrats. "Alice is universally and greatly admired," wrote her proud husband, "and she seems to grow more beautiful day by day." An old friend, separated from the Roosevelts by lesser means, caught sight of them emerging from an opera at the Academy of Music on 14th Street. Theodore had manifestly arrived at the social heights. "I remember thinking what an enormous start he had over youths like myself, whose daily bread depended on their daily effort." New York, at the dawn of the 80s, stood poised between the sedate elegance of its past and the fabulous vulgarity of its future. This was at once the age of slippery horsehair furniture and Tiffany glass, of dignified quadrilles and the scandalously sexy waltz, of pre-phylloxera burgundies and the harsh but interesting new cabernets from California, of copperplate invitations on silver trays and the first crackly telephone messages, of Beaux-Arts filigree decorating old blocky townhouses. Millionaire's Row was not without its vacant lots, and Alva Vanderbilt's vast chateau at 52nd Street, designed to humble Mrs. Astor, was still a skeleton of limestone and marble dust. Not until its last turret was in place and its doors thrown open to the splendor-seekers could New York's golden age fairly be said to have begun. Yet already the pace of society was accelerating. For the young Roosevelts, hardly a night passed without some brilliant affair. Since the opera did not